Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming out so we could learn together. And thank you, Gil, for organizing and bringing the sushi, obviously, and for putting this all together. Yashar Koach. So I want to study together an episode, a period, which I think to many of us might seem completely unimaginable nowadays. Even the term interdenominational cooperation, even leaving aside the term halachic, just let alone any sort of cooperation. What's that? Yeah, exactly. Are you asking me to leave? So that itself might seem unimaginable, and certainly once we insert the word halachic, it completely is something that that we could perhaps only dream of. Maybe for some a dream, for some a nightmare, depending on your perspective. So let's go back. Immediately after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Committee on Religious Activities of the Jewish Welfare Board. The Jewish Welfare Board was an organization, a system that was created to provide for the needs of Jewish soldiers in the military, of American soldiers in the military. Just I think it was 2 days after Pearl Harbor, Committee on Religious Activities of the Jewish Welfare Board was reorganized. Up until that point, up until... Yes?
Was it the U.S. government?
No, it was separate. It was separate. It was not a U.S. government body. It was a Jewish organizational communal body. And up until that time, until the U.S. entry into the war, basically between the world wars, it had been providing the little or the few needs that were necessary for Jewish soldiers in the military. But with the entry of the U.S. into the World War in the end of 1941, there was a need, all of a sudden, I mean really all of a sudden, for a much larger and a more organized system to help and manage the needs of men who were enlisting into the military. What did this, is all by way of background, so what did this... Jewish Welfare Board, do at the time, again, with the entry of the U.S. into the war, its first priority was to recruit chaplains. There were a handful of Jewish chaplains, but it sent out basically a notice to the three main rabbinic bodies of the Reform movement, of the Conservative movement, and of the Orthodox movement to recruit rabbis to serve in the military, and that's indeed what happened. Believe it or not, to our credit, if you will, each rabbinic body really stepped up to the plate and recruited many rabbis, rabbinic students, as well as established rabbis to serve as chaplains in the military. A few weeks after Pearl Harbor, and so in January of 1942, the Committee on Religious Activities was reorganized and renamed as CANRA, the acronym CANRA, which was the Committee on Army and Navy Religious Activities. And again, the main priority of this committee was to assist chaplains in providing for the religious needs of Jewish soldiers in the military. However, and this will bring us to what I want to talk about tonight. One of the first committees, or subcommittees, if you learn a Jewish organization, you need a lot of committees, right? So one of the first subcommittees of CANRA was the Committee on Responsa. Responsa is the fancy English name for Sheilot Tshuvot, right? Halachic inquiries and answers that are given. Namely, they anticipated that with the enlistment of hundreds of thousands, I mean, these are the numbers, of hundreds of thousands of Jewish soldiers of varying observances, commitments, and backgrounds, there would be many questions that came up as to how to act and how to behave and how to go about living a Jewish life, in the in the bases here here in North America, as well as on the battlefields overseas. And in a fascinating kind of historical anomaly, who was part of this committee, or who chaired this committee, I should say? One representative of each of the main rabbinic bodies. So there was a reform representative, there was a conservative representative, and there was an orthodox representative. They wanted three to kind of, they modeled it after a traditional Beit Din type of model, even though it didn't have that stature, but they chose one representative of each of these of each of the main movements in American Jewish life. So who were these representatives? The Reform representative was Rabbi Solomon Freehoff. I don't know if that name means anything to anyone. He's actually a really interesting figure. Maybe we'll have another opportunity to talk about him. But he's like the posek, if you will. Again, it's a little bit of a strange term to use, of Reform Jewry. He has many responsa. Even though he was a Reform rabbi, and right, Reform's attitude towards halacha is well beyond the purview of tonight. But in general, on traditional sources with his own interpretation and sort of a Reform, you know, bent on it. But he was there are collections. If you go home and Google Solomon Freehoff, you'll find many collections of his responsa. He was a rabbi in Pittsburgh. The conservative representative was Rabbi Milton Steinberg, who I'm sure the name as a driven leaf, right? So he's most famous for that. He was also the rabbi of the Park Avenue Synagogue, not to be confused with the Park East Synagogue, which is an Orthodox congregation. The Park Avenue Synagogue, till today, is a conservative synagogue in Manhattan. So he was the conservative representative. And the Orthodox representative was Rabbi Leo Young, who was for decades the rabbi of the Jewish Center in Manhattan, and a very well-known and very prominent representative of Orthodoxy here in the United States. So the committee was confronted with many difficulties, not the least of which, and they state this, there's a book that was written about Canra. The title of the book is Rabbis at War. Okay, so obviously, which can be obviously can be the title of many books in Jewish history, but in any case, I don't know why he chose that. It's written by a fellow by the name of Philip Bernstein, who I think was a chaplain or was involved in the Jewish Welfare Board. In any case, he tells the story of Canra, and included in that is the story of the responsa committee. So they were faced with many difficulties. Number one, they state, whereas many rabbis can say, "I'll get back to you," or right, "I'll let you know. Let me look it up." When you're obviously dealing, particularly with battlefield situations, the answers need to be quick and they need to be concise. So they state that was one challenge that they faced. The questions came from chaplains, they came from soldiers, they came from the government itself at times, wanting to know what the Jewish position was on a particular issue. And obviously, right, one that we're probably all thinking about already is one major challenge is, well, how do you accommodate, you know, the different viewpoints on halacha of all things of the different movements in American Jewish life and world Jewish life, the different denominations. So theoretically, it would seem that such a committee would be unable to function, right? You can't find, in many cases, an answer that would satisfy these different viewpoints. But in practice, it's fascinating that they did, if you look through the responsa, if you are interested in looking, so much of it are printed in this book that I just mentioned, Rabbis at War. But a much easier way of getting it is if you go on Safaria online, it's actually there. All of the responsa are provided there. So in any case, with few exceptions, where either the Reform representative or the Orthodox representative, Rabbi Young, will state some sort of disagreement, but they're few and far between. And most of the responsa were given as a unified answer to the request or to the inquiry that was given. The purpose of the responsa committee, as we said, was to provide quick and concise answers. And before we get to the source sheet, I'll just give you like a very quick overview of some of the types of questions that they faced. So they were faced with ritual questions, particularly as it related to, again, just give you a couple of examples, to Shabbos. So soldiers that were serving in areas that crossed or were near the international dateline, how should they, right, in the Pacific, how should they observe Shabbos? When should they observe Shabbos and the like? The answer that was given there for the most part was, since this is a matter of dispute amongst the rabbinic authorities till today, so we're not going to come out with a defined answer, and you should follow what basically, if I remember correctly, what the locals define as Saturday, right? That's what you should, which is one of the answers that is practiced. What about observing Shabbos in the northern latitudes, where right daytime or nighttime can last months? So what do you do? So they actually in that case, they point to a case that is actually quoted in the Shulchan Aruch itself about if you're in the desert and you don't know what day Shabbos is, so you choose a specific day. I guess you kind of figure out a little bit what it is. You choose a day and you make Kiddush and you observe that day as Shabbos. So soldiers that were stationed in whatever, you name it, right, up there. So that was the answer that was given to them. There were life cycle questions that were presented to this committee. One, again, a couple that just stood out to me. One was that a soldier was, I think he wasn't overseas, but he was stationed in a base far away from home here in the U.S., and he needed to make a pidyon haben on his son was going to be 30 days old, and he needed to make a pidyon haben. So they, I wasn't aware of this, but he said that you can make a pidyon haben through a shaliach, through an agent, and that was the psak that was given. Another question that was given was soldiers are going to, they were, a soldier was with his fiance, and he was being, he was going overseas or whatever, he was shipping out, and he wanted to know if he could get married on a Friday night. That was kind of the day or the time that that worked out. In Europe, they used to get married Friday afternoon, right? Here he asked Friday night, and they said, no, not going to work. Those are some of the questions that, again, just to give you a sense of some of the questions that were brought to the committee. I want to point to three main tasks, and this will get to the source sheet now. Three main tasks, if you will, that the committee had in front of itself. Three main tasks / objectives that it had in dealing with questions. And we'll see one example from each, and hopefully that'll give us a sense of some of the difficulties and challenges that were faced. One task that the committee, and again, some of these were explicitly stated by them, and some of them are a little bit more implicit, but they wanted to make it clear that the rulings that they were issuing were based on wartime conditions, that these were not necessarily to be followed, you know, during peacetime when the war would be over, and they wanted to make it clear that that was the case and that that should be understood as such. The second objective that they made for themselves was, as we mentioned, that they wanted in this case, and it's somewhat related to the first, I guess, but they wanted to have that unified answer, again, with those few exceptions that that I mentioned. But given that the government And the military, right? The military doesn't want to hear, you know, 50 Jewish opinions, right? So every Jew has an opinion. The military is not interested in your opinion, right? That was the case, right? They wanted a unified response. And soldiers also, they didn't want confusion. So they wanted to make sure that they were issuing a unified response. And so, perhaps this was the most challenging task at hand, was that they wanted to bring about that the rulings would be, would satisfy the three different, again, not just movements, but views on halakha that were being represented. So that was the second objective. And the third one is, I think, more implicit in the responsa, is that the committee made sure to navigate military norms. What I mean by that is that they didn't want any of their rulings to clash with what the military, they didn't want to clash with any sort of military activity, or God forbid, impede any sort of military activity, right? They wanted it to be in consonance with military needs, military objectives, and the like. So with that in mind, okay, so now we can go to the source sheet. Yeah, of course. Yeah, so, right, so they write that, right, of course, right, so obviously you have to do what you need to do, right, in times of war. They're talking about if you can avoid certain things or you're not needed, right, when do you observe Shabbat, or even on the positive side, like, when do you make Kiddush and stuff, right, so that's also just, okay, so in terms of the first objective which we saw. So we'll go in order. So in terms of the first objective that we saw, all of the responsa that I quoted here on the source sheet, sadly but understandably, has to do with death, burial, mourning, which sadly is, you know, a reality of wartime. So in terms of the objective of making sure that it's understood that their rulings were only for wartime. So let's look. We won't read every word here, but let's read the question, and then we'll see at least part of the answer, and we'll see what I mean by the wartime conditions and the like. So he writes as follows: A veteran, number one, a veteran died in the Japanese prisoner of war camp at Osaka, October 19th, 1945. And the U.S. Army asked of our committee the following questions. Does Jewish law permit cremation? A. B. Does Jewish law permit burial of cremated bodies in a Jewish cemetery? C. Is there any requirement of a special place in this cemetery where the urn is to be buried? D. Can the urn be buried separately, or must it be buried in a casket? E. Do you have a regulation-sized grave or a smaller grave? And F. Do you have a similar service as in all other services for repatriated bodies?
This was asked by the Army.
I believe this was asked by the Army, this one. I believe so. What's that? Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah, totally.
I'm not understanding the situation. It was a Jewish...
Yes, a Jewish soldier died.
Who was working, or he was a prisoner of war?
He was a prisoner of war. He was captured by the Japanese.
The Japanese wanted to cremate.
They did cremate his body. They did cremate. No, no, no. Okay. No, the Japanese were not that nice, as we know. Correct, correct. That's what they're going to say. So he was already, this Jewish soldier was Nebuch already, he was taken prisoner by the Japanese, and his body was, he died in the prison camp, and he was cremated, and now his remains, his ashes, were now being brought back to the U.S., and they wanted to know, how do we treat it? How do we treat this person's ashes?
One more on the topic, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, basically, right? No, the Emperor of Japan was not asking Shilas, no. Okay, so they basically say, so cremation is not allowed, right, in general. I'm reading from the second paragraph here. As to the burial in a Jewish cemetery of the ashes of one who has been cremated, there is less unanimity of opinion. Most of the opinions, interesting which sources, by the way, they quote, but okay, not for now. Most of the opinions prohibiting such burial were collected by Mary Lerner of Altona, Germany, in his book Chaye Olam. However, the opposite side of the question was taken by his contemporary, etc. And then they go on to say, again, you can read, I don't want to read every single word, you don't need me for that, but they go on to say that there are authorities that permit the burial of a cremated body in a Jewish cemetery. As they say, Audrey, in the last paragraph on this page, right, it is not necessary for us to decide the moot question as to whether burial of cremated ashes is in general permitted, since the burial of the ashes of this soldier forms a special case, and there will be other special cases like it. This soldier was not cremated by the United States Army, which does not practice cremation. Interesting, by the way, that's a tidbit. But by the Japanese in the prison camp where he died. In this case, the situation of the ashes is exactly, listen to this comparison which they make. In this case, the situation of the ashes is exactly the same as the situation of the ashes of those who were murdered by the Nazis and whose ashes were sent to the nearest of kin by them. I'm not sure who the them is. I'm not sure who the them is, right? I can't imagine the Nazis were doing that. But
at the very beginning, they did that.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
At the very beginning, before they had houses and all of that, at the very beginning, they actually would send remains to families. It's kind of bizarre.
Really?
Who knows if they put the right stuff in or whatever, but...
Wow. I had no idea. Thank you. Yeah, wow. That's surprising, to say the least. So they say this is not a typical case. Right? This is not a typical case. This person was taken prisoner of war, and their body was burnt by the enemy. And listen to how they define. I find the definition to be inspiring. Also, listen to how they define the top of the second page. They belong to the category described by Maimonides in Hilchos Avel, namely those who are killed by heathen governments, right? The Rambam talks about Haruge Malchut, someone who's killed by a non-Jewish, or really an enemy, oppressive government, and are not to be deprived of any of the rituals involved in mourning or burial. The Rambam's not talking about a cremated body. Right? So it's an interesting application. The Rambam's not talking about a cremated body. He's talking about a body of a person who was killed by an oppressive a government. Here, they're taking it a step further. They're extending what the Rambam says to this cremated body. These soldiers, victims of enemy cruelty, whose bodies were cremated without their prior consent or the consent of their relatives, must not be deprived of any of the traditional Jewish rites. So number one, right, they say, is that we're obviously not talking about a typical case, right? So if you come, right, and person's relative, God forbid, dies and wants to be cremated, so obviously we would tell them no. But this is not the situation here. This person never consented to this. This was done by vicious enemies, by brutal enemies. And so we're going to treat their remains just like we would treat the remains of any other person who was killed by an oppressive government, an oppressive enemy. Right? So number one is that they're defining the case as something which is atypical and therefore applies in this particular type of situation. But they go even further with that type of definition. So listen to how they say the remains then should be buried. Moreover, in order to not give the impression that the burial of the ashes of the cremated is to be permitted in general, right? This is wartime. This is not regular, these are not regular conditions. We advise, interesting choice of words, right? Well, we advise that the urn be placed in a regular sized coffin and buried in a regular sized grave. So as not to give the impression that what? That there's a cremated body over here, right? Meaning when you walk through the cemetery, it shouldn't look like, oh, we have options here, right? There's, you can buy the big grave for the body, or when uncle, whoever dies, right, I can save a few bucks and buy the small grave for him if I cremate him. They don't want to give that impression, right? They want to make sure that people don't get the impression that cremation is okay in peacetime. Okay, and that's right. So those are the two, in terms of that, So that's a great example of where this committee is making sure that A, they are understanding and ruling based on their understanding of the, say the least, atypical but extreme conditions of wartime, but not just they, but others have that understanding also. And these their rulings should never be applied to peacetime, to quote-unquote normal conditions. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Insight into how decisions like the Supreme Court gets the 9 people or the other, and they come out with one opinion, you don't even know necessarily that somebody drafted.
Right.
You got 2 people in New York looking at this, or how does it
happen? That's a great question. I'm not 100% sure. I don't know if they recorded basically how they came to these conclusions. I'm not 100% sure. It's a very good question. Yeah.
It wasn't.
I don't think so, because again, they wanted to come to something a ruling that would satisfy everyone. Okay. The second objective that we said that this committee had was that they should, like we're saying, right, Andrew, that they should come to a unified decision, that it would be something that satisfies everyone. Now, let's take a step back. There are one or two tshuvos in these responsa that are clear that they don't satisfy everyone. So, for example, there's one question there that was presented to them about a soldier who wanted to get married again during the war. And the woman he wanted to get married to was a second marriage for both of them. And there was no record, not just no evidence, the woman never got a get, right, from her first marriage. So it's clear that in that situation, right, so the Orthodox representative, I forget if he writes, this would never satisfy, you know, basically the Orthodox approach. That's clear that it would never satisfy the Orthodox approach, right, the reform adopted, I think, in the early part of the 20th century, if I'm not mistaken, that a get is not needed and civil divorce is sufficient from their perspective, right? So that's a case which clearly there was no way of coming to a unified decision. In some cases, the unified decision is just stated as one in unified front, right? There's one statement given. And at other times, as we'll see over here in this next question, they state actually, well, if you're from a Reform background, this is how you should act. If you're from a more Orthodox background, this is how you should act. So look at source number two. The question is as follows. Again, sorry that they're all about death and dying, but would it be fitting to have the tallit placed inside the blouse, since it is not practical to dress the bodies of Jewish soldiers for burial in traditional burial clothes, shrouds, tallit, etc.? Meaning they couldn't put what we call tachrichim, right, on the Jewish soldiers. They don't state why, which is interesting. So I'm not sure if because just the bodies were not in condition to do so. I'm not sure if that was why in some cases, or in some cases maybe the military had certain conditions that by which they had to be buried. I'm not 100% sure. But in any case, there are traditions about how to, and customs about how to bury a body. So they say, should we put the talus, right, which at least from an Orthodox halachic perspective, we try to bury a body in. We have already discussed, so they say, we've already discussed the question of burial in a talus with regard to soldiers fallen on the field of battle. In their case, we have decided that they should be buried as the Jewish law permits in the case of the slain in the garments in which they were, found, i.e. in their uniforms. So yes, so they should be buried in their uniforms, but what to do about the talus, right? So do we put a talus around them as well? So listen to what they answered. It should be said at the outset that soldiers should be buried as they would have been buried if they had died as civilians. It's a very diplomatic way of answering the question. And by the way, you find this very same diplomatic, almost identical formulation when it comes to other responsa here in this collection. So when it comes to, for example, I believe, a marriage ceremony. So they say, well, the chaplain, we don't really care what the chaplain is, right? But what background is the soldier who's asking? Does he want a more? They're not forcing a chaplain to do something against their beliefs, but they should take into account what the background of the particular soldier who is asking. So that's exactly the case over here. So let's keep reading a little bit. Sons of Reformed Jewish families who would be buried in civilian clothes, i.e. without a talus, right, are buried with their military clothes without change. As for Orthodox boys or boys from homes of strict observance who would be buried in a talus, the Orthodox practice should be followed. If the body is turned over to the family, they will, of course, see to it that traditional practices are followed. Right? So basically, we need to take into account, in order to accommodate the wide spectrum of backgrounds that these soldiers are coming from, so we need to accommodate that. And it's not really our call, right, as chaplains and as rabbis on this committee, it's not our call, but we're here to respect the wishes of the soldier and of the family. And then they go on, okay, so once you're putting on the talus, so how exactly, right, if the body is being buried in military uniform, how do you place the talus, where, etc.? Okay, those are more technical details. But here you have a prime example of this desire to not just be diplomatic for diplomacy purposes, but to really satisfy not their approaches to halakha, but to satisfy the families and the soldiers that to whom this really applied. So that's one that was another task, if you will, or objective that this committee had. The third one, which we mentioned, this is a pretty tragic and wild case. The third objective that we mentioned is that they never wanted to clash, as I said, with military priorities, with military norms, right? If this is what the military thought was necessary, so they're not going to say, oh, but Jewish law says no, and you can't do that. Or Jewish law says you have to do X, Y, or Z when the military says that's problematic. So the third case is a really prime example of this. It's a tragic case, but listen to the case is and what they rule. Is burial on the Sabbath ever permissible? And source number 3. Is it permissible during the war emergency period? A plane crash took place, killing several military men, of whom one was a Jew. The post authorities made all arrangements for the funeral, which occurred on the Sabbath. The chaplain was asked to participate and agreed to participate insofar as the military honors were concerned. But he explained to the authorities that Jews do not bury on the Sabbath. But the bodies were so mangled and in such condition that it would have been better to bury them at once. How can burial on Sabbath be permitted on the battlefield? Okay, so that was the question that was posed. So they discuss this Talmud Yerushalmi that seems to imply that maybe burial at one point in time was done on Shabbos, done al yedei nachri, right? Was done by non-Jews. Parenthetically, by the way, on Yom Tov, there's a whole question in halacha about burial on both the first day of Yom Tov and the second day of Yom Tov. There are still communities, as an aside, there are still communities, some Hasidic communities, that still bury on the second day of Yom Tov, on Yom Tov Sheni. Pretty wild to think about, but still done.
Some non-Jews wait for the body for 24 hours and then bury his body.
On Yom Tov Sheni, I believe.
So what about the Tahara? Can you do that on Yom Tov?
That I'm not 100% sure what they do about that. Yeah, interesting question. Okay, let's continue. Second paragraph here. Nevertheless, in spite of this implication that burials may have taken place on the Sabbath with Gentiles performing the necessary work, the law is clear that burial on the Sabbath is forbidden, and then they say even for a meis mitzvah, right, even for somebody who has no one to bury them, we don't do so on Shabbos. Skip to the next paragraph. This general prohibition applies to normal circumstances. So again, we're kind of getting an intertwining between objective number one and objective number three. Yet even in civilian life, in case of an epidemic, if the government orders the immediate burial of someone who dies on Friday evening, then the burial must take place. In wartime, they're quite explicit. Listen to how they state this. In wartime, a military command sets aside the laws of the Sabbath. Period. Full stop, right? So they're very black and white about their the need and desire, the necessity not to clash with what the military or the government is ordering. With regard to a man in the last paragraph here on the page, last three lines, on the battlefield where a burial detail is specifically ordered to bury the dead, the Jewish chaplain and whatever Jewish soldiers receive the order must bury the dead even on the Sabbath. One thing I was wondering about is, in terms of the communication, how these rulings somehow got to the battlefield, so quickly. I'm not sure if this was asked kind of after the fact or at the time, in real time. I'm not sure what. I guess so. Right. Well, we've come a long way in terms of communication, but I'm not sure then. But yeah, you're probably right. Okay, so turn to the next page. Back of the battle areas, or in the United States, when specific military order is given for immediate burial owing to an epidemic or a catastrophe, such as an airplane accident, when the condition of the bodies requires immediate burial, then this specific order should be accepted without question, and the body should be buried even on the Sabbath. Aside from these exceptional circumstances, burial should not take place on the Sabbath. But in exceptional cases, as referred to above, the chaplain should consult the officer in charge as to whether the burial may not be postponed to another day when burial is permitted according to Jewish practice. So if you can try to convince them, but if not, then as we saw before, right, the very explicit statement was, if the government orders the immediate burial of someone who dies on Friday evening, the burial must take place. In wartime, a military command sets aside the laws of the Sabbath. Okay? So there is, they want to, and understandably, want to cooperate fully with military priorities and with military commands. Let me just finish and then I'll come to your question, Audrey. Okay. Dr. Young adds to the above, this is an interesting little caveat, right? Dr. Young adds to the above that while, as mentioned, that the burial should not be opposed by the chaplain, the usual service should be modified. So you open up your RCA Madrich. There's no page for burial on Shabbos, right, as to what to say, but I guess you know, if God forbid someone's in such a circumstance, so you, modify, somehow you figure out what to say or what not to say. Yes, go ahead.
What's interesting, Nancy, is you might have thought, obviously, that would have said, trying to avoid having Jewish soldiers involved to dig the grave. But
right.
I guess they wanted to leave no room that maybe this isn't the right thing to do.
Ah, very good.
Specifically put that
yeah.
in.
That's a great point. It's reminiscent of the Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos, who says it's a mitzvah on the, you know, the gadol and the rav to be osek, to perform all the duties needed for the saving of a life, right? Don't try to get somebody else to do it for you. Like, no, it's a mitzvah for you to violate Shabbos. And to take care of someone who needs it. So there's, by the way, another case. I'm going to conclude in a few minutes. I know there's another case where of a similar situation where they're told to violate Shabbos, where there was not to violate Shabbos. Excuse me. They were asked about performing an autopsy on a body of a Jewish soldier that died in a military hospital, and they said there should be no objection in this case to the autopsy. If the military orders it for medical purposes, they need to know, right, if there's any sort of disease or whatever that's still that's in the body, etc., that they need to know you know, have medical answers. So then they said that we should fully cooperate with whatever the military orders. What's that? I don't know if that Dina Machlut Adina is more. I don't know. I don't know if that will apply to wartime. I'm not sure exactly. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. So I want to end, and I think it's a fitting conclusion with one last question and one last really the answer is what I think is most fitting in terms of how this committee saw its viewed its role during the Second World War. We spoke about their own priorities and their own objectives in how they issued these rulings. But I think this question, and again, particularly how they answer it, really shapes in a way how they viewed their overall role and the overall role of the, again, hundreds of thousands of Jewish soldiers who were fighting for the United States during the Second World War. So the question is here in source number 4. We have been asked 2 questions with regard to the procedure which should be followed when the bodies of soldiers who died overseas are brought back to the United States. Should the bodies be taken out of the caskets and washed, inasmuch as the ritual washing tahara was very likely not performed overseas, right? So should we take them out of the caskets and perform a tahara? And B, since the bodies will be brought in closed bronze caskets, I guess that's how the military transported bodies, should the bodies be transferred to the open wooden caskets before reburial in a Jewish cemetery, right? So we always bury in a wooden casket. In Eretz Yisrael, I mean, really, try to bury right closest to the ground as possible. Even there they bury in Israel without a casket, but we bury here with a wooden casket. It's natural, right? So it should be taken out of the bronze the metal cast caskets and put into a wooden casket. I'm sorry?
Why doesn't
they
open wooden
caskets? I think by open they mean kind of like what we do. There's like holes on the bottom. That's my impression. That's how I read it.
They can easily be opened. They're not sealed. Like, I don't
know. Yeah. Could be. Yeah. Interesting. I always understood it as like something on the bottom that has that provides contact with the earth. Yeah. Okay. So they talk about the tahara question. Not so interested in that right now. They talk about not taking it out because a body shipped from overseas, so the condition of the body is probably not particularly great at the point that it reached the United States during that time. If you look, give me 1 second, I'm sorry, let me just find the exact place. So skip towards the second to last page, the last paragraph. Okay, sorry, I should have put a little arrow there. But look at the last paragraph on the second to last page. It says, May we not say, therefore, that while indeed it is not the custom to use a metal casket, yet these soldiers who gave up their life for a righteous cause be deemed righteous, and therefore do not listen to this, it's a very powerful statement, and therefore do not necessarily need direct contact with the earth. That therefore the cast be not disturbed or pierced, but they be buried in the earth as received. Meaning a full, profound recognition of what cause these soldiers gave their lives for. Moreover, all these bodies had previously been buried overseas in wooden coffins, and indeed some without coffins. Thus, the purpose of burial in contact with earth has been amply fulfilled. I think just that statement alone, and feel free to read through the entire ruling, but I think that that statement alone kind of frames what these three rabbis felt they were not only what their specific role was, but their specific role within the entire war effort that they were fighting a righteous cause, that these men who gave up their lives for a righteous cause, and the religious system, right, that was there to provide for their needs, the system that was there to provide for their religious needs, was part of this global effort, was part of this effort of fighting this this righteous cause. In fact, there's another question, and I'll end. There's another question that was asked of them about burying Jewish soldiers, specifically in, I forget it, I didn't put it in front of me, I forget if it was specifically the cemeteries overseas or even back home, next to non-Jewish soldiers, or specifically, as our, you know, definitely what we generally try to do is to bury Jews in a Jewish cemetery. And there's a statement there that they make, that these, basically these soldiers, both Jewish and non-Jewish, were brothers on the battlefield and all fighting for the same righteous cause. And maybe, you know, they can be buried that way as possible. I don't think they conclude that way, but it's certainly a strong havamina, as we say, right? A very strong possibility that they raise. So again, as I began, it's almost impossible to think that on matters of halacha there would be a committee of three very prominent rabbis who would work in unison so strongly and so amicably, but it was really as they state in the final tshuva, in the final ruling that we said, that this was part of an effort, and they realized that these were not normal conditions. Maybe this is something to strive for under normal conditions. I'm not saying yes or I'm not saying no, but in any case, they realized the period that they were living through, and they realized the cause that they were fighting for and that they were part of, and so therefore they realized that they needed to rise above their kind of normal attitudes towards halakha and towards each other, and to be part of this. So, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Those skins, the ones that are not as recognizable outside of, like, you know, of the topic?
Yes.
Are these considered among the Orthodox religions, sort of like reasonably authoritative?
So that's interesting. It's a great question. So let me back it up for a second, actually. The committee writes that because they needed to give very quick answers to questions, right? So they didn't have the time or the ability to do, you know, the full research. So the question, the answers are relatively short. I mean, these are actually some of the longer ones. The answers that are given in this response, and by all means, go home, go on Safari and look them up. They're fascinating. So they're relatively short. They generally, if I remember correctly, only quote like Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, and, you know, kind of like the codes, as you will, right? The cheat sheets, if you will. But to get to your question specifically, Gil, I don't think so. Like, I didn't recognize a lot of these. Now, it could be, you know, let me put it this way. Sometimes, you know, kind of rabbinic, what's the word I'm looking for, right? The preferable books that rabbis turn to, I'm sure, are cyclical. So, you know, I'm sure the early rabbis in the early part of the 20th century didn't look at the same books that rabbis nowadays tend to turn to. So it's possible that these were some of them that they turned to more often, but not ones that I was so familiar with. So, yeah, good question. Yeah, Alan.
Has this set a precedent for wars after?
So, good question. So, if you look on Safaria again, you'll find the main collection, which is where these rulings are taken from. And then there's another short collection, which is called something like Responsa from Chaplains or Two Chaplains or something like that, which is a much shorter collection of rulings that were given in a few years subsequent to the Second World War, so a few years after the Second World War. I think it goes from like 48 to 53 or something like that. So maybe included the Korean War. But after that, so this committee disbanded and not to be had again. Yeah.
Does anybody ever use this as a reference?
Yeah.
So they write in their kind of introduction to all of this, they write that they actually initially did not want to record their answers for the very reason that we said they didn't want people to rule based on their ruling, right? But they said maybe circumstances will come up again, where, you know, these types of rulings will be needed. I'm not familiar to answer your question in full. I'm not familiar with anything that's been written for soldiers in the American Army. In Israel, there is a very large literature of what they call in Israel Hilchot Tzava, right? Which is, there's a plethora of books on this written by prominent, Rabbi Ramon has one and others, of everything from A to Z that a religious soldier or any soldier will need, from, you know, Shabbos to Kashrus to, you know, more serious life and death questions. So in Israel, there's, for obvious reasons that we can understand, right, there's a whole literature on this. Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, for better or for worse, I mean, how many religious soldiers can we even think of offhand, right, that are asking these questions? I'm sure there are. There certainly are, but it's certainly was not in the numbers that.
The mainstream,
I didn't see any. It's an interesting question. I didn't see any, and I think maybe to answer the question, I think maybe it can be reflected in what I began this year with in terms of one of the main objectives of this CANRA, right, and the Jewish Welfare Board was to recruit chaplains, and really. I mean, I'm not going to say every, you know, there are all kinds of minor and smaller rabbinic organizations out there, but the main rabbinic bodies, I mean, really mobilized in terms of recruiting chaplains and rabbis leaving their pulpits to go out to war. Maybe it's easier for some rabbis, but right, it's easier than being in the pulpit. But but in all seriousness, they really what?
Nothing
value provoking. Yeah. At least they give you a gun, right? They really, really did mobilize. So I didn't see any objections. So, yeah.
I think all the people who didn't know the piece of this last day during the war, but I think, you know, the Vietnam experience for everybody.
It's interesting you say that. This book, Rabbis at War, he actually begins in his prologue or his introduction by saying, it was written in 1971, I think it was published, and he says something like, hard to imagine a war that had such a consensus amongst the U.S. population as we find ourselves, you know, in the middle of Vietnam. He actually writes it.
We didn't do the attacking.
No, 100%. Yeah. 100%, both against Japan and against Germany. Yeah, 100%. And so it's interesting that you say that, yeah.
Of course, you
know, well. Yeah. All right, thank you so much. Thank you.